The Arthropod. The Arthropod is the home for the wonderful, weird, wacky world of insects. Hosted by Jonathan Larson, Jody Green, and Michael Scavarla.
Welcome back, everybody, to Arthropod, your entomology podcast. I am but one of your hosts for today's session, Jonathan Larson of the University of Kentucky.
I'm another one of your hosts. I'm Jody Green from the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
And I'm Michael Scavarla with Penn State University.
And he's bringing the heat.
I haven't had a really excited entry in a while, so.
You would be big on AM radio with that kind of voice.
Or college radio.
College radio. Speaking of college, our episode today is kind of dedicated to college. We're going to be talking about some of our philosophies, I guess, in regards to getting into grad school. We actually had a listener request to talk about the graduate application process, some of our thoughts and opinions on the different schools around the country. And instead of ranking them and giving ourselves a bad name by insulting the various universities, I think we've decided to talk about it in a slightly different fashion, but we hope it's still helpful to those of you who are considering a path in entomology that would include graduate school. We hope you enjoyed our October content. We got to do brown recluse spiders with Rick Vetter. We got to talk to Crystal Hans at Purdue about forensic entomology. I thought it was all really awesome. I know that Jody had a great time with both.
Yes, I did. It was fun.
Maggots and brown recluse spiders. Like, what's not to love, right?
Oh, yeah.
But today we're going to zoom in on this graduate school process. And I think we're all, are we trepidatious? I'm trying to read the room across Zoom here.
I did it in a weird kind of way, and I wouldn't recommend the way I do anything. So my advice is to be a little more involved with the process. I kind of just go with the flow. And that was, I mean, it worked out for me, but like, I think today's students and future grad students are really much better at doing the research and putting the time and effort into finding what works for them for their future. Like I've always said, I'm not a very futuristic person. And I think with graduate school and possible careers, that's a futuristic thinking thing. And so I'm not the right person for
I think you are the right person. I'm excited to have your portion of the show recorded today. Mike, how are you feeling about our graduate school discussion?
I like this topic, and I hope it answers the listeners' questions, even though we're not maybe coming at the question the way that they had anticipated that we would. So I think it'll be useful.
Yeah, we're all early-ish career professionals. We had to make these considerations back in the day. And I remember this feeling, right, of like, oh, I need to rank these. I need to look up the rankings. You want to go to a prestigious school, et cetera, et cetera. It's a very fraught process. And we're kind of locked into that thinking even in high school, right? I was on a locked path to go to Purdue. Like that was where I was going to go to college or else, basically, because I got half off. My dad was a staff member there. So Mike, you had a slightly different experience. You got to pick Purdue. You got to end up there as an undergrad, but you're still sort of locked into that thinking. Like we get these rankings sent to us. I remember getting those magazines and seeing it in the Wall Street Journal and stuff, like the top colleges in the United States. And I think that follows you into your graduate school experience. And maybe we can talk more about that as we each describe our own journey to graduate school. We all did our undergrads, then we were kind of looking for the future. And I'm going to pick on Jody first. what was it like for you to choose to go to grad school? What was that journey like? Like what happened for you?
Okay, so I'm going to say that graduate school chose me. I had never thought about one, bugs or anything about it. Uh-huh. Two, moving to the United States because I grew up in Canada. Three, I had no idea where Purdue was or what Purdue was. Isn't that horrible? And it was very backwards in terms of the way things are like consciously thought of now for students to be looking forward. I had an undergrad that was completely not science. I mean, it was social science. So I did an undergrad in gerontology. That's the study of aging. And then I did an associate's degree at like a like a School of Natural Resources college that was so much fun. I guess like college and university is very different in Canada. So university is like the four-year degree, very books academic. And the college, what we call college there, is like what you call associate's degree here. So it's like a two-year hands-on kind of trade. And that's what I did. And it's usually like you're kind of geared towards a certain path when you have certain grades or standards with family members, and the pressure is like, oh, you're going to go to university. Oh, you're more of a college type, right? So even in high school, you have the different classes and pathways. And I always was geared to go to university. And then when I went there, I was like, boring.
Well, you weren't that passionate about the degree.
Oh, I wasn't at all. Like, yeah, I just went, I gave my diploma to my mom and I was like, here you go. Hope that, you know, whatever money was worth it, I'm going to go do what I want to do now. Bye. And then I like moved to this small town and was ice fishing. And we had like a class called small engines and resource drilling. Like, I was outside, like taxidermy, wildlife fish. Like, it was exciting.
You taxidermy things?
I didn't go into taxidermy. I went into environmental pest management, and that's how I got into like chasing rats and, you know, beavers and all sorts of like fun, exciting things. So that's probably why I get really excited when Mike says like, oh, we were at this deer station. Cause like at heart, I really love like Canada wildlife, outside, like doing gross things, fun stuff, exploring, curiosity. And so in a way, my brain was not really meant for university, right? Like, I probably always should have been outdoors doing like what I love. And I think when you find that passion, you're going to keep going on that way. And it just happened that when I reached out to learn more about entomology, because I was really pest management, all sorts of pests. And when I was done with that program, I wanted to know more about entomology. And I wanted to know more about insects. So I reached out to the person who wrote my favorite book, which happened to be Gary Bennett. And my favorite book, of course, is like this textbook called Truman's Guide to Scientific Pest Management. And I could never check it out of the library because it was a what is it called? Like one of those books.
Reserved.
That, yes. Yeah. Could not check it out. Could not afford to buy it because it was so expensive. So I just reached out to him and he said, oh, you should come to grad school here. And I was like, I don't even know what this means.
Yeah, I guess I find this very intriguing. Like, you just described yourself as somebody that didn't want university. You went to college, the Canadian version of our associate degree programs or our trade schools. And then you got a call to be like, oh, like take the next step for university, go to Ultra University, go to grad school. And what intrigued you the most about it?
Like, I didn't even know what that meant. So, but he was like, you should come here. And I was like, well, he wrote this book. Like, he knows a lot of stuff. Like, I would love to be one of his students, even though I don't know what that means. I don't even know. I don't even know where Purdue is. And actually, I knew that they had like an online correspondence kind of course. And that's what I wanted to take. I was like, I just want to know more about pest control, insects. And I know that there was like a distance education. They have a lot of courses there. And it was like, why don't you come down? And it was in January when I contacted him. And by August, like, I had already moved down there and started a year of sciences to try to get all the requirements I needed to get into grad school. So I just went for it. And I was very fortunate that my parents were like on board to take me down there. And because I was not only like a non-resident, but I was an international student, all the money and the funds that I needed to be able to go to school was pretty much like, I don't know, you know, second mortgage almost. Like, it was a lot. But I think because I was so passionate about doing this thing that I just like moved out of the country. Like, I actually had a boyfriend at the time. I was like, see you later. Bye. Like, I was all in, even though I had no idea what I was doing. And when I said Purdue is in Indiana, somebody that I had worked with said, you know what? In the States, all the states that begin with the letter I, those are the nicest people. That's where you should move. And so I was like, Indiana, Iowa, Illinois. Okay, I'm good.
Idaho may challenge that.
Yeah, that one never came up.
Sorry to our Idaho listeners. So I guess what I love about this story, I've heard it before. We've shared it probably on the show before.
Does it surprise you?
No, it's not that it surprises me. It's that it perfectly shows, I think, because Mike and I will counterbalance this. Like, I feel like there is this feeling amongst students nowadays of like peak optimization. How do I optimize my undergraduate experience so that I am ready for graduate school? You know, like, I don't want to take any of this stuff because it distracts me from getting to graduate school. Beyond just getting to graduate school, there's almost this automatic emphasis on like, I'm getting to a PhD program. You know, how do I make this happen? Like, they're the machine, a cookie cutter way of doing it. And I feel like half the stories we hear from entomologists, you could shuttle them into that. And then the other half is you and like all these other cool people who are like, I just like kicking rocks and picking up crawdads. And then somebody called me and was like, hey, you want to learn about this for forever? And you get into it. And I want people to know that that's an option. Like, you don't have to feel destiny has called you to be an entomologist or destiny has called you to graduate school. Like, I don't want to say if it's meant to be, but like, if the opportunity arises and it's in your heart, like, you did it, right? I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah. Like, I was invited down. Gary Bennett offered me like, okay, this is what you have to do for a year. Cause you didn't know. I had to take Dr. Aceta's whatever class to collect insects. I had never done something like that. All the insect behavior, all these core classes that you guys got as undergraduate entomology students. I didn't have any of that. So I had to catch up. I had to do maths and sciences and stuff. And I didn't do the greatest, but I knew I had to get that to get into the master's program where I would have the assistantship to have the money. So it was like only that 1 year of catching up, but it costs like a lot of money. And when you're an international student, I think at that time I was on like an F1 visa. There's a lot of rules, what you can do, what you can't do. And also when I moved down there, it's kind of morbid, but it's like, you need to have the money that in case you die out of country, you have enough money to send your body back home. It was like $500,000, but it's like,
because these are what?
Yeah. Like, my parents had to say like that we have the money in case she dies at like in college down in the States, that we have enough money to ship her body back.
I understand the concept of that. But $500,000 seems like an insane amount. Like,
yeah, it was
insane.
Been like,
oh, yeah, $5,000. We put you in a box and we ship you up there in a truck. And
right. Yeah. I had to say like, hey, just leave me there. It's fine. Like, I'll be dead. I won't know. Like, I'll be doing what I love doing, you know? And
bury me by the Wabash River.
Yeah. So, I mean, I know all the sacrifices that went into it. And yeah, I never knew that was going to be a career that I wanted to do. Actually, during my master's, I was a grader for that same course that I had reached out initially to take. So I helped with those correspondence courses. And then after that, I actually rewrote some of them. So
nice.
I was very involved. And yeah, I mean, if I consciously had thought about it, there would be a lot of things that would have been stressful, right? I didn't have that.
Right.
I had different stresses.
Well, and what I like also about your story is it was Purdue, right? Like, I mean, you were going to Purdue. You didn't have all of these like, okay, am I going here? Am I going there? What's this place? I mean, you talked to one advisor at one university, you went there and you did it. And that is a style of doing this, of going to grad school. Like, this is a way that you can do it. It's not luck or anything. Jody had the skills. She had the wherewithal to seize an opportunity. And clearly there was something about her that sparked interest from Dr. Bennett at Purdue. Like, this is a way that you can get into grad school. It doesn't have to be peak optimization all the time. Now, Jody arrives at grad school. Simultaneously, Mike and I are enrolled at Purdue University as undergraduates. Mike and I were part of the same entrant class. At the time, we were the largest undergraduate class in Purdue entomology history. We were very proud of that fact. We ran things there for a while, this class of people that went in. And we knew Jody. She was sort of a semi-legendary figure in the department. We knew her as like the queen bee, basically, of the grad students. And we were trying to figure our way out through undergrad. We got to be rising seniors. Mike has probably an interesting story to talk about because he graduated early, a semester early, right?
Yeah.
So we're going up into our senior year, our junior year. We have to figure out what we're going to do about grad school. And I feel like we have a very different story than Jody, which probably fits more of what the inquirer that spurred this episode is dealing with right now. So, Mike, I was hoping maybe you would share your grad school hunt, as it were.
Well, so like you mentioned, we were both undergraduate entomology students. And honestly, the way I picked undergrad and grad school were kind of similar. So I only applied to 3 undergraduate programs, Cornell, Penn State, and Purdue. And Cornell accepted me provisionally, but I would have to go to a different college for my first year and then transfer in. Penn State accepted me if I went to a branch campus first, and then Purdue accepted me to main campus. So I was like, well, this is an obvious choice.
I don't want to get too far into the weeds, but isn't that a thing at Penn State a lot? Like they send people to satellite campuses first before you come to main campus?
Yes, not always, but frequently. And I'm not sure why they did that for me in particular, but obviously they lost me as a student because of it.
Sure.
Which is funny now that I'm here.
Right.
So it made that it was like, well, this is the obvious choice. I'll go to Purdue. And so for grad school, it was, I guess during my undergrad, I didn't, coming into it, really know what I wanted to do. I was like, entomology, let's work on insects. But then when you start to look at grad school, you really have to have an idea of like, I want to do X, Y, or Z. Like, I want to be a taxonomist. I want to work on, you know, molecular something or other. I want to work on pheromones. You have to have an idea kind of what you want to do. And by the time I was done with my undergrad, I'd realized like, I'm really good at insect identification. Like, I didn't know that going in, but like, I like this taxonomy and systematics stuff. So I started looking for systematics programs. And unlike Jody, who just kind of had an opportunity fall into her lap, like I started reaching out to professors, because in entomology, one of the ways that you can find somebody that will take you is just email a bunch of people that are doing work that you like, ask if they're taking students. 95% of the time, if you're just cold emailing them, they'll be like, I don't have money for a student.
Right.
Sometimes you get lucky. So I emailed probably 20 or 25 different professors. So in a cold email like that, you have to lay out briefly, because professors are busy, who you are, what you're interested in, what you've done. I'm looking for a program. Are you taking students? This isn't always the case, but I got lucky. Almost all of them emailed me back. Even though it was a no, that doesn't always happen. A lot of times professors ignore it. I know now as a professor, I get 1 to 3 emails a week from prospective students, like all fall, asking if I'm taking students. So it's really easy to have those get lost in the shuffle when I'm also getting 80 to 100 other emails a day.
Right.
So
what's this bug? What's that?
Yeah. Yeah. If a professor doesn't email you back, it's maybe not because they're intentionally ignoring you, but like we get a lot of emails, and it's easy to slip through.
What subject heading or title would make you stop and look, or actually put it aside to look at it? Like, stop, prospective student.
Yeah, I put prospective student.
In, read me.
I put prospective student in my header, and that's when I see those as a professor now, at least I know what's coming. I don't have funding, so my answer is always, I don't have funding. I'm sorry. Good luck. But at least I know like what's coming and what's going to be in the email. Yeah. So I reached out to, I don't know, 20 or 25 different professors. Only one professor had money to fund me. And so we emailed back and forth a few more times. I wanted to work on taxonomy. Ashley Dowling, who ended up being my major advisor, worked on mite systematics. And I thought to myself, and maybe I even told John this, like, I'm never working on mites. Mites are terrible. They're so small. I hate them. Never going to do that, but maybe he'll let me work on something else. And so we emailed back and forth a couple times. They set up a visit for me to come down. In-person interviews like this are often the last step. One for the professor to make sure that the student is somebody they want to take, but also for the student to make sure that the professor is somebody they want to work with. That went swimmingly. And my now wife, we were dating at that point when we were undergrads, and I called her from Arkansas and just went on for like 10 minutes about how amazing it was and how much I want to come down here and I hope they take me. And she thought at that point, like, oh, and this is going to end up in us breaking up. Like, he's not going to want to do a long distance relationship. And we ended up getting married and then had a long distance marriage for a year because she had to finish her undergrad. But
and then one of your kids being born in Arkansas.
Yeah, one of our kids was born in Arkansas. But yeah, so I reached out to individual professors that I knew were doing work that I wanted. asking them if they had money, asking them if they were taking students. I got lucky. One was. And so that kind of formed my career from there. The fact that Ashley was the one that took me and not somebody else. If a coleopterist or a hymenopterist would have taken me, I would have worked on beetles or wasps, and that would have changed my whole career trajectory. But because I went down to Arkansas with Ashley, within a week and a half, they convinced me to work on mites,
right,
which ended up being one of the best decisions of my career. I stayed there for a PhD because I was a good student. They had money to keep me, and it just went from there.
Yeah. And you had spent the whole time as your undergrad experience, like getting experience, doing all these things so that you would be an appealing student to these people. I think you've hit on one of the kind of core anxieties about this is like this step does define perhaps not only the next 2 years if you're going for a master's program, but ultimately like the next 10 to 30 years of your life. Like there are decisions that you're making now as an undergrad looking into grad school that will change things. I mean, it can be kind of an anxious process.
Yes and no. I guess I'd push back against that a little bit. Just at least from my perspective and where I am now, obviously I'm trained as a systematist and a taxonomist. That's what my master's and PhD and postdoc were in. But after I got this insect identifier job at Penn State, I haven't really worked on mites in a taxonomy sense or taxonomy in general since. I kind of converted to this much more extension heavy position that led to me working a lot in med vet stuff. So I've been working on deer keds and ticks and all of these other extension concerns, which was an interest of mine as an undergrad. I really, you know, I had kind of these two paths. I could be a taxonomist or I could go towards the med vet side of entomology. I went taxonomy, but I still, you know, this big looping path came back to it eventually because it's an interest of me and I have some flexibility in what I do. So, you know, the decision did set me up to be a taxonomist, but ultimately never didn't define my career in certain ways.
You have answered the question that I was about to ask you, which was, would you agree that it's not necessarily going to set in stone what you do, but it gives you the core capabilities that you need to be successful in the future, which is exactly what you've laid out. You were trained as a taxonomist. You were able to parlay that into an extension role, like fully different than where you had originally started. So yes, that was what I was hoping to build towards. You cut down my tree early. With grad school, it seems like this momentous thing, like you'll be set in stone for forever, but there are ways of adapting. We have a good friend of the show, Amy Murillo, professor at UC Riverside, I think is a good example of this. She, for her master's program, was in a turf entomology laboratory, and now she's one of the lead poultry entomologists, med vets stuff for the state of California. And so she ended up finding a very different path later on. I'm truncating her story quite a bit, but it's not a forever decision. It feels like it because in the moment, you know, it's going to change everything about what you're doing, but there are ways of altering your future no matter what when you're in grad school and after.
And I guess we should say, like, it's not that it has no impact.
Right.
It certainly does narrow your options, and it is difficult to really convert from one subfield to another, but it's not impossible.
Right.
And we have obviously two good examples of people that have done it, but you can get siloed by what you do. People will see you as like, well, that's the taxonomist, that's the chicken person, that's the turf person.
Right.
But there's ways to get around that and ways to change your career trajectory too.
Absolutely.
Jonathan, are you going to tell us your story?
Sure. My story is very similar to Mike's. I have some added complications. I, as a senior at Purdue, I was engaged to my now wife, Kara, and we were going to graduate in May, get married in June, and then move in July. Like that was the plan to get to grad school. My wife has a PhD in biochemistry. She is the smart one. I'm the pretty one, is how I always joke about it. And we were trying to find grad schools together, which is not a fun process. I don't recommend it to people necessarily. We each sort of laid out some schools. We had to stay within spitting distance of Indiana as well due to some family stuff. And so we were kind of looking at Michigan, Illinois, Kentucky, Ohio, and then we also had Virginia Tech and North Carolina on the list. I looked up those departments of entomology because I wanted to be in entomology still with my undergrad coming from an entomology department. I started finding people who had similar interests to me, which included like horticultural entomology or people that were doing entomology education, and started cold emailing them, prospective student interested in your program. Many of them came back negative, just like Mike described. No funding. I don't take students, this, that, or the other. Others say, come back in a year. I got a few of those. Like, I'm going to have a grant next year if you can wait a year. And then others, it was like, I'd really like to talk to you. And some of that was based on who I'd worked for as an undergrad. I ended up with an interview at NC State that I was very keen on, but my wife didn't get into University of North Carolina. So we had to kind of cross that one off the list. She got into Virginia Tech. I couldn't find anybody at Virginia Tech. And then the only place that we both got in that we could both go to school at was University of Kentucky. My current employer, I hope that they don't listen to this. We were neither of us very pleased with the situation, frankly. It was the last option. It was not what we wanted to do. It ended up working out for both of us in the end, but I ended up here because it was the only place that we could both go to school. I was trying to look for somewhere that I could start as either a PhD or as a master's that would transition into a PhD program. It was just the only place that ended up working out. So lots of emailing, a couple of in-person interviews, and a couple of offers. Ended up having to pick one over the other because of getting married. So I guess my story is kind of weird too. It's a very human process.
Were you looking at just schools, or were you looking at labs within schools? Like, you applied to and got into Kentucky. Were there multiple labs that you could have gone into? You ultimately went into Dan Potter's turf entomology lab.
Yeah.
You've like gone to different paths at that point.
Yeah. I actually had two interviews down here. My other interview was with Dr. Lynn Riske-Kinney, our forest entomologist. She was sort of interested, but I don't think I quite fit the bill for her lab. She was starting to move in a more molecular direction. I didn't really have that background. And Dan Potter, he was looking for somebody that would dig holes and collect bees and get covered in bug guts, and was willing to talk to people. My whole thing was I wanted to end up in a lab that I could parlay into extension experience. I knew that I wanted to do extension or outreach when I got done with school. So I was looking for a topic that I thought would fit in that mold. And I didn't want to do corn. I apologize to any corn entomologists that are listening, but I grew up surrounded by corn. I desperately didn't want to end up in corn. So I guess I was looking geographically first and foremost, and then from that geographic initial sort of like narrowing of universities, I would go in and find labs that I thought I could connect with. I would cold email like 3 to 5 people at each.
So me and you both went the cold email route looking for schools, but there's another route that none of us have gone. So I'm not sure how much we can talk about it, but that's applying to just the department in general and then figuring out which lab you go to after that.
Yeah. So we have rounds of that here at Kentucky. Maybe you can talk about it at Penn State as well, where the director of graduate studies will say, we had these 5 people. They just applied to be in the Department of Entomology here. Are there any people interested in taking these students? I find that has a low success rate. I don't know about you, Mike.
Yeah, it depends on the student. We have a similar thing, except they throw all of the students that have reached out to professors individually and all of the students that have reached out to the department but don't have a professor in mind. They put them all into like one pot and have them all visit at the same time and kind of score them and rank them, like, who are we going to bring in? Because we only have a limited number of assistantships to give out. So if a professor doesn't have external funding, they can get a preferred student on an assistantship, but they're also, I don't want to say fighting, but they're competing with other students for those assistantships. Penn State is kind of this hybrid of what students are coming in, and because we have a limited pool of kind of communal money that can fund them.
I think that's very interesting. We're getting into some of the nitty gritty. So maybe define what an assistantship is.
Well, I guess there's different ways to be funded in grad school. The easiest way is for the PI or the major professor that you're going to work with to have secured external funding through NSF or some other big granting agency that includes student funding. When that happens, it's great because your funding is secured and they can just pay you. There are other routes to be funded.
usually TA ships or research assistant ships. And both of those are different. And even coming to Penn State as a professor, I had to figure out the difference because I wasn't sure quite what we did here. At Penn State, we have research assistantships where they just pay you to do research. The funding isn't tied to teaching or anything. You're just paid to be here. We actually don't have TA ships here. You can't teach to get funded. Other universities, they will hire you on a TA assistantship where you're expected to teach X number of classes, usually through your graduate career. Sometimes it's like one class a semester or one class for the first three or four semesters you're there. Doing that teaching is what then pays for your graduate school.
And you run like labs and things like that, right?
Yeah, it depends on the class, but sometimes it's just grading. If you've got like a giant intro class that has 500 students, sometimes you're running labs. It really depends on what classes are being offered, what class you get put into, what sometimes you will actually be doing some of the teaching. The professor will have you do a guest lecture on a certain topic, or this happens more in like maths and things where you're running like a study group that is outside of the class. What are those called? They have a name. We go to
bio help session and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, like there were help sessions that were required for you to go to for credit, but they were run by the TAs. That's less common in entomology, but depending on the field that you're or the school that you go to may be available as well.
It was kind of like jobs that you have semi-related to what you're doing that helps fund your studies.
Right.
For grad school. So for me, since I was in the urban lab, a lot of our things were like sponsored research. So like different chemical companies want us to test like this so-and-so bait that's not developed, like in development, test that on, you know, your ants there. So we have colonies of certain insects and we test it on that. And then we write up the report. And so that's like sponsored research. But also my assistantship was taking care of the roach colony. That was my job. I was running the urban pest management conference, was grading and doing work for those distance education classes. So they were different duties depending on which lab you're from and where that money actually comes from. So because I wanted to be in grad school, I could never not do the duties and responsibilities and the things that were expected of me because of my assistantship. So I didn't have to TA or teach, but it was like, these are the duties you have to do. And sometimes it would be not so much some weeks and then, you know, 90 hours a week, the week of conference, but that was my job, you know?
So I think that that's something that's important to talk about too. It's somewhat of an elephant in the room. I think particularly in these maybe more modern or more progressive times, I know that when I went into grad school, I knew I was not going to get paid much, right? You get 20,000. I don't know what you guys got. I think I was like 20 or 21 when I was when I was a graduate student. My wife was $24,000 or $24,000 maybe, but you're essentially getting paid half time. You're getting paid to be a 20-hour a week employee. And then the other 20 hours per week, quote unquote, are supposed to be dedicated to being a student. Like it's the graduate and then the student part later. In reality, it's going to be a lot more time more often than that, than a 40-hour work week. And there are a lot of duties that get assigned to you. So I don't know how to necessarily dissect that. Maybe both of you can help me kind of muddle my way through this. But it in this time of, I guess, work reform and trying to get more justice for people who do jobs, it seems very unappealing. I don't know how long this model of graduate school can live. Maybe this is way too out in the weeds for a graduate school talk or discussion like we're having, but I guess it's sort of a word of warning, like be prepared for somewhat of a weird situation that may make you feel taken advantage of. Is that too far to say?
Well, yeah, it's always like, give it to the grad student. Oh, I have grad students that do that. And I think we worked it out once and it was like $2 an hour sometimes, like what we were doing. And you just think, well, on the other side, I'll come out with this degree and I'll be able to, you know, make this back and we'll be rich. And after you finish grad school, like we thought we were rich just to get a paycheck that we could go and like pay a veterinarian to get our dog's teeth cleaned. That was the first thing we did with our paycheck.
Wow. That was very kind of you.
there is a lot of discussion ongoing about how we pay graduate students, because the line in the past has always been like, well, we're covering your stipend and covering this and covering that. And really, you're making like $70,000 a year. But it's all this made up money that the student never sees, because like the school is just paying itself and that money doesn't go anywhere.
Right.
I mean, so they could just wave it away and be like, whatever, like these fees and stuff don't exist anymore. And it would be the same.
Healthcare, your tuition gets paid. In most cases, if you're going to go to grad school for entomology, you're not going to pay for your tuition. And then, yeah, you're on top of that, you're getting this quote unquote stipend, this $20,000 to $25,000 a year. I know there's been internal discussion seemingly at every department about boosting those numbers. It's such a weird situation, it seems like, where we can't do that. We can't afford that, I would argue, as departments, but it's also not fair. It's not equitable treatment of, go ahead.
Oh, I don't know if you've seen some of the kind of open access stuff that especially on Twitter people have been putting out, but there's only like one graduate entomology program in the country that pays above cost of living.
Yeah.
So like we bring these students in and hand wave all these fees around, like we're paying you a lot more than you're getting. But when you give them, you know, $24,000 and cost of living is $30,000, students can't live. Like,
right.
And professors often, especially older professors, often don't think about that because like they haven't been in that situation for so long, or there's like, well, that's just the cost of being a student. Like I did that and everybody else has to go through the same pain I went through when I was a student. Like, of course you're going to have roommates or live with, or have a second job that you don't tell anybody about.
Yeah. I was going to say, which we also make illegal, like your assistantship is contingent upon not holding an outside job. So it's a very fraught process. And I'm not saying this, I'm not putting this out there to scare people away from graduate school, but it is something to be very conscientious of, that you're making a very nuanced choice. If you're going to go to grad school, you are not going to make money. You are going to survive for 2 to 6 years, depending on how long you're in there. And it's not easy and it's not fun necessarily. And I'm not even talking about like the work, just financially speaking, it isn't a healthy situation. So think about that as you make these decisions, and use that as part of the decision-making process if you're going to get a master's or a PhD. I alluded to this earlier. I meet all these students that come through here that are getting started. You know, we have our intro to the department class and I get to talk with them. And so many of them nowadays, it seems to me at least, they are skipping the master's and they're going straight into the PhD. They go from senior in college to PhD program. And I guess I'll be political on Maine and say, I don't like that. I don't think that's a very healthy way to go about things. I think everybody should start as a master's student for at least a year. And I don't say that because I don't think people can do it. I made that switch. I was a master's student for 2 years before I sort of petitioned my committee to fast track. But those 2 years are very valuable to me because I learned how to be a scientist. I learned how to do graduate school. And if you jump right into a doctoral program, you're sort of saying, I already know how to do all that. I don't need any time to learn how to set up a scientific experiment, how to write a paper. I don't know many people that I would say fit that bill. Or do you guys think I'm all wet on this?
No, I totally agree. I think every student should do a master's before a PhD. And if you get to the end of your master's and decide you want to keep going, maybe fast track to a PhD. I think there's like you said, there's a lot of learning and training that can be done. It also offers an off-ramp.
Yes.
I've met a bunch of students and know a lot of students where they get into a master's program, realize they hate it, and it's not what they want to do. You know, it's one thing to be a year into a master's program, hate it, but think I can stick this out for one more year and get a degree at the end and then either do a different PhD in a different program or go into industry or do something different. Yes. Like sticking it out for 1 year is difficult, but doable. But if you're a year into a PhD program and have that same realization, like you've got 3 to 5 more years ahead of you. And that is like, at that point, you should probably just quit because you're not going to want to do it. You're not going to produce good work and it's going to be miserable for everybody. And so you've wasted a year. Whereas going into a master's, like I said, you've got this off ramp where you can change your trajectory. You can go into a different field. You can get out of entomology and do industry. Like you can change a lot easier without having to sacrifice much more.
And I think it's a lot easier to go forward, right? If you're a master's student and you want to be a PhD student, that's a happy process. Like everybody's like, yeah, all right, no, you're great. We want to do this. If you're a PhD student and you say, I want a master's, then it's kind of, your advisor may be upset. They'd signed you up for 5 years, expectation of getting 5 years of cooperation with you. You know,
yeah, this like there's is a feeling of failure all around that may or may not be warranted.
Exactly. And I really want people to, I hate like my, I've mentioned Kara as a biochemist. Her program didn't have a PhD. This is why I was looking for somewhere that I could spend my whole graduate career at. They give you a master's if you fail, basically. And I think that's a garbage approach. A master's is not failure. Like there are plenty of jobs that are master's level positions that are really good jobs. Like not just monetarily, but like ease of life, happiness, quality of life. Like don't feel bad about getting a master's degree. Don't feel bad about wanting a PhD either. But like, if you can get it done in 2 years and then get the job that you want, don't be in grad school for 4 to 5 more years that you don't need.
To backtrack just a second and thinking about the financials, like what opportunities are there after you're done with your undergrad? Because if you do go into grad school and you're not making that money that you could be making at an industry job with your undergrad, that's going to be, you know, lost income that may or may not be worth it come retirement. You know, looking back, having 7 years or 6 years of very low income when you could be making double, triple, quadruple that and banking some of that when you're young in a retirement fund, that's going to be a lot more effective when you go to retirement than having a lower income for a number of years. And then after your PhD, making what you may have made coming out of an undergrad, but going into industry. In every year that you're losing that potential retirement income could hurt you 20, 30, 40 years from now. And that's that kind of long-term thinking isn't something that undergraduates often think about.
It sounds like you've been to a TIA CREF session recently, perhaps.
Well, it's just one of the things that you need to think of in balance.
It's very important. I absolutely agree. And I think part of that decision-making, maybe we're way off script here, but like when you're getting done with your undergrad, there's going to be people, I mean, we all knew these people that were like, oh yeah, you just need to go to grad school. Well, why do I need to go to grad school? Why? Like everybody that is graduating from an entomology program, a biology program, like, why are you going to go to grad school? What's the point? I went to school with some people when I was a graduate student that like you asked them why they were in grad school. I don't know. It was the next step, right? It's the next thing to do. They didn't have, I don't want to say a mission or anything, but if you're going to go to grad school, like have a light at the end of the tunnel, have something that you're working towards. Otherwise it can be a much more torturous process.
I guess I do want to say one more thing about money too. There are some grad students from, you know, poor backgrounds where they come into grad school and even at $24,000 a year, that is the most money they've ever made and maybe the most money some people in their families have made. If you want to go to grad school because you're good at research and you want to make that money and maybe that's the best kind of monetary offer that you've gotten, going to grad school to make money, it's not going to be the best way to make money. But if that's the most you've ever made, that is a perfectly fine reason to go to grad school too, if you're good at it. You know, I see this, at least on Twitter, like people say, like, I went to grad school for the money and that was the reason. And people will get on them about it. Like, whatever.
Twitter's not real life anyway, right?
I mean, it isn't. And it's probably not going to be here for much longer.
Oh, you're going to get us kicked off.
But like,
right.
You know, we're talking about grad school, not making a lot of money. Like it is a lot of money for some people. So.
Excellent point to make. I appreciate you bringing it up. I think we've been on some soapboxes here so far. I think one of the things that when we got asked to talk about this particular topic, if you Google entomology departments or if you Google entomology graduate rankings, you can find several lists. I included some in our outline and I'll put them in the show notes. They're from such reputable sounding websites as like University Raptor or College Hippo. Not really sure you know, how accredited some of these are. Others, what did we have here in the list? Let me go back to it. Others could be like College Factual. We had College Raptor, universities.com. You'll see that they rank out a lot of these different programs. Some of them are national for the United States only. Others are sort of North American and they go up into Canada. Some of them are even global lists. And we love rankings, right? I mean, as a species, we love to see things ranked out. You have to look no further than like college sports to kind of get a sensation of that. And I think it makes it seem like it's a helpful decision-making thing where you can be like, okay, I got an offer from Colorado State and I got an offer from the University of Delaware. And this one is ranked 13 and this one is ranked 17. I'm going to go to number 13 instead. And I think that's a small trap that you can fall into with this. What do you guys think about that? Do you believe in these rankings or are they useful for this process?
I mean, it's useful to see what's out there. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously I didn't look at any rankings or anything like that. I'm actually pretty lucky that Purdue's a great university, but I mean, it's good to see what's out there. And, you know, the Entomology Society's got all the list of all the places that you could get entomology degrees. But I mean, it kind of depends on how they rank it and what you're looking for. So I wouldn't base my choices on that ranking. You'd have to look deeper into what specifically you're looking for.
Yeah, I think it's a difference between undergrad and graduate school too. You should look deeper even at undergraduate schools, but it may be a more important thing to you at that point. But when you're going to grad school, the relationship that you have with your major advisor is going to be the relationship that defines your career at that stage. And so honestly, the rankings, I don't care. They don't mean anything. If you have an advisor that you do not connect with and is even adversarial, you're going to have a terrible time at grad school and maybe drop out because it's so bad compared to having an advisor that supports you and provides the resources that you need. Grad school is going to be a lot easier. So the relationship that you have with that person is going to be a lot more important than the ranking of the school in every case.
Yeah. So maybe we should talk about what are the important things that you should look at if it's not the rankings of the school of entomology of where they are, or that mentorship's important, being able to be funded. What are the things that you need to look for before you pick a school?
So when you're starting the process, I guess my first advice would be finding somebody whose interests match up with yours. Mike and I described our undergraduate experience with that. Jody described that as well. Her favorite book was edited by Gary Bennett. And so she reached out to him. I reached out to multiple professors that worked in turf, ornamentals, trees, all the horticultural type entomology. Mike reached out to folks who worked in taxonomy. So finding somebody who shares your interests first and foremost that can give you a home in this subgenre of entomology that you want to work in. I'd say that's step number one.
So like the project.
Not even the project. No? Yeah. Like it's just the universe in which you will work.
You should like it and enjoy it. And it should be something of interest to you.
Yeah. So I can speak from my experience. I had an offer from NC State and I had an offer from Kentucky. Both of them were in horticultural entomology. But at one, I would have probably been working on climate change and scale insects. And at the other one that I ended up picking, I was working on ecotoxicology, but they were both projects within the greater universe of horticultural entomology. So I think finding that universe that you want to work in and then hearing out what the project is, if you're willing to commit to it, like, do you have the physical capacity to do it? Do you have the interest in it? Are you going to be put in situations where you could catch on fire or be struck by lightning? Like listen to the project. But first, find those people that you can connect with on the broader topic. Mike, do you agree?
I definitely agree. And I think finding different jobs that you can do around the department as an undergrad can help with that. I got into Jeff Holland's lab as an undergraduate worker, and his slogan is bugs, maps, and math. So he does a lot of stats and a lot of computer stuff. And I have no interest in that. But what he did do was bring in a lot of diversity from longhorn beetle traps. And I loved that aspect of the lab. And so right away I had this inkling like, oh, maybe I should do something with like diversity. Then after that, I worked in the museum and realized I really like taxonomy and working in the museum. So that really helped me as an undergraduate figure out the path or the subfield that I wanted to work in. When coming into an undergrad, I was like, entomology, all of it. I love insects.
And I had no kind of conception of these different parts of it. So I think as an undergrad, finding a different jobs too, like work in different labs to get some of that experience if you can.
It's as important to find out what you don't like and what you don't want to do.
For sure.
It's more important to be able to say, yep, let's move on to something else.
And that'll help you find the subfield that you like. And then from there, the advisors that you could potentially work with.
So let's talk more about that part. You have made contact with somebody. There's interest mutually based on the project and everything. How do you know, how do you make sure that this professor passes your vibe check, so to speak, if I can use the parlance of our times? Like, what is it that an advisor should be, and how can you find out if they're going to fit that mold?
Did you get to meet your future advisor in person? Like, did you go visit?
I did eventually, yes, later in the process. So I came down to Kentucky. I had a meeting with Dan Potter. He took me around all these different golf courses. I almost fell asleep in the truck because it was after lunch and I was in a sunbeam, and apparently I'm Garfield the cat. And I'm glad that I didn't, because I think that probably would have been an instant fail. But yeah, I got to talk with him. I will say that the things that I wanted to hear were things that he brought up. Where are my students now? This is how I run things in my lab. Most professors are willing to admit if they're a micromanager, or, you know, what's their leadership style? What's their communication style? And then I think one of the most important things is, are you ever left alone with the students that are in the lab? And that can be tough, particularly with new faculty. They may not have anybody else to expose you to. Mike was in that situation. He was one of like the first two grad students for his major advisor, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I was the second student, but the first PhD student had only started 6 months before. So,
and I was joining a lab, and Jody was in the same boat. Like, we were joining legends in their own time, people who had very established programs. So I find it important to have the opportunity to be left alone with students to ask them questions. And grad students are notoriously honest about all of this stuff. And I think if they felt you were entering a bad, I had heard about that before, where students would be like, no, you shouldn't join this lab, or you don't seem like you would enjoy this lab. I think that's an important thing. What do you think, Jody?
I do. I agree with you. And I think that the advisor or the mentor would also want you to be happy, right? We would always have kind of gatherings when someone would come visit the school, the grad students, to meet with that potential, and they could ask any questions. And so, yeah, we were pretty honest about it. Also, former students who have maybe graduated from that lab, there's your cohorts, the ones that are there when you're there. And then there's like, what do you guys call it?
The alumni.
Your lab family, like how you're related. Like the lab that I was at, there's so many people in the industry that I still see that are all like descendants or graduates from or the urban lab. So getting to know them and saying like what they learned, what it would be like. So it's like, you know, this is how it's going to be. He's very hands-off. You will learn a lot, not necessarily about this, but you will have these skills when you're done because you're pretty independent. You know, he was never going to tell you what to do. So sometimes it doesn't work for everyone because some students need direction. And there wasn't even a project there. Like, I had to come up with my own projects, right, which is probably pretty bad because I didn't obviously know what I was doing, but I was always part of the development throughout the whole process. I wouldn't recommend that for any, you know, for everyone either.
I think the other thing that you just hit on that is important is, maybe you both feel differently. I don't feel like I had the opportunity as an undergrad to do that kind of soul searching, to know what kind of mentor I might need, to know if I need a micromanager, to know if I need independence. I know I have sort of an oppositional, defiant personality, so I was pretty sure I didn't want to work for a micromanager. Do you think that's an important thing to question about yourself, like what sort of leadership style you need going into this process?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, for sure. To your point, or similar to you, like, I knew I wanted somebody that was more hands-off in grad school because I knew I would be independent and I would much rather enjoy it. I wanted somebody where I could come up with my own project, and if I had questions or problems, they were there to like help me work through them. But I also didn't want to come into a lab and just be handed a project and say, here is the outline, get this done in the next 4 years. And that worked really well for me. Ashley was pretty hands-off, and there would be times where I wouldn't see him for 3 or 4 months at a time if I wasn't having issues, and he wouldn't even come and check on me. Like, I'd just be working and getting stuff done, and I'd either have an update that I thought he needed to know or problem or something, and I'd like, hey, can we schedule a meeting? Or I just walk into his office and be like, hey, I need 10 minutes, which worked really well for us. We had a couple students come into the lab while I was there that needed more hands-on, a more hands-on approach, and didn't do well because they didn't get that.
They needed more structure, it sounds like.
Yeah, and that's not a dig at Ashley per se. His mentoring style and what they needed didn't mesh as well as it did with me, and so they struggled more. And so doing that soul searching in yourself, knowing what you need, does help. And then kind of asking questions about mentoring styles, both to the PI and the students, because a PI may think one thing and then you talk to their students and they have a different opinion of it. Like, oh, mm-hmm. I'm really hands off. And then you talk to the students and they're like, no, they're not. That can help, especially if you're deciding between a couple different places to go.
I think that there are some other things that are really important to consider in like the choosing a mentor aspect. A lot of what we've just described comes down to management style and a match with you. It comes down to them presenting a project to you that's appealing. But there are other things that you should get as a graduate student, that you deserve as a graduate student. One is financial support, not only with your stipend and your tuition and everything, but also the ability to attend meetings. That should be something that you ask. Am I allowed to go to Entomology Society of America? Can I go to a branch meeting? Do you fund your students to do these kinds of opportunities? You should also be able to ask questions about the project, like where is the project going to go? What's the publishing plan for it? I went to grad school with some people that unfortunately got put on like proprietary projects. There were some, I mean, I'm not going to get too political about it, but like there were some streams crossed and they were working on things that were a part of company work that was part of an entrepreneurial bent for their major professor. And they didn't really get to talk about their work. You should have the opportunity to be open and give presentations about your work at regional and national meetings. And they should be able to present to you the opportunities that they're going to be able to offer you. Like, where are you going to get to go? Is it the Florida NSOC, the National NSOC, the Southeast Branch? What is it that you're going to do if you're applying there? I think those are all questions that should be asked and opportunities that should be given. Do you guys have any others that you think you should consider as questions during the interview process?
Can I also just go back and say, if you have the opportunities to go to those meetings and you have plans or desires to go further in grad school, it's always good to network and meet people there, go to their talks, go to their students' talks, see what they're doing, what kind of research is coming out of there. And that can also be a good deciding factor if you think that you want to go there and these are interesting to you.
I agree that like going to meetings and being able to present is an important thing. And you should talk about that with the professor. Sometimes they may not have the resources to send you. So I guess I speak from my own lab. Like my budget's like $1,500 a year. Unless I get an outside grant, my lab runs on shoestrings. And so I often can't send students at least to every meeting. Like I couldn't send my student to Vancouver for the ESA meeting this year because I can't even afford to go myself.
Right.
But we are going to try to get my one student to a branch meeting next year because that'll be cheaper. And the national meeting will be in Maryland, so we'll be able to drive down next year.
Perfect.
So we'll get her to that. My other student, Logan, is interested in water quality assessments. So he's an entomologist by proxy. Like he works on insects, but he is an entomologist, but he's not interested in like entomology writ large. So I ended up sending him to a couple regional kind of water meetings that he got a lot more out of than he would have gotten from the national entomology meeting. And those ended up being a lot cheaper anyhow. So we could, you know, even on a shoestring budget, I could send him. So depending on what the professor's financials are like, you know, talk to them about it, ask if they can send you. And I'm open with my students when they ask about it. and say, like, I may or may not be able to send you every year, depending on where it's at, depending on how expensive it is. And if you're okay with that, that's fine.
That's the exact thing that they need to hear, I think, is that the person you're talking to should be honest about it. And Mike would be honest. I've been honest. You know, I've told people, well, no, I can do it this year, but not next year, or we can save it up and it can be part of your like last year experience, et cetera, et cetera. But like, that's an important conversation to have as part of the interview process. You are interviewing them as much as they're interviewing you. I know that's a cliche thing to say, but it's a cliche for a reason. Like, you need to make sure this opportunity is going to work for you. Don't take anything out of desperation is another piece of advice I would have. Have we covered everything?
Do you want to talk about land grants versus kind of other institutions?
Sure. As Jody mentioned before, if you go to the Entomological Society of America's page, they have a list, a pretty exhaustive list of places that have a department of entomology or a merged department of entomology and A, B, or C sort of linked to it, or a department that features a lot of entomology. It may not be in the name, though. I think that's a very helpful list if you want to be an entomologist. If you want your graduate degree to say entomology on it, these are the places to look. A lot of that is going to be located in the land grant system here in the United States of America. The land grant colleges are where most dedicated entomology programs are going to be found.
But there are going to be entomologists at other colleges. You know, they may be primarily master's conferring colleges or other liberal arts colleges and whatnot. But if there's a department of biology, they may have an entomologist there. It's going to be harder to find those folks because they're not in a department of entomology. But if you find somebody that's doing interesting research that you like, and they are at one of these other types of universities, it may be worth considering applying to their program as well, because again, it's going to be different from undergrad in that you're taking a lot fewer classes, especially as a PhD student. So not being in an entomology department is going to be less important than what the professor is doing research-wise and how that meshes with what you want to do.
It was interesting to see like the Canadian list, because like I had never consciously applied to be an entomologist. So looking at these places, I would never have thought like Department of Biological Sciences for entomology or, you know, bugs. So if I were going through this process again, so many universities closer to home and one that I actually went to. So.
And I guess we should say too, this is primarily focused on the United States and in somewhat Canada. I'm not sure at all how it works in Europe or other Australia or other areas. So if you're one of our listeners that's across the pond or elsewhere in the world, some or none of this may apply if you're trying to get into grad school elsewhere.
Yeah, I guess we didn't go into like email etiquette or anything, but, you know, using formal titles, having a generally collegial tone that uses formal language, all of that helps.
It's not a text message.
Yeah, I don't want to be like an old fogey about anything, but it does matter. And if I get, you know, if it's a very familiar tone at first where somebody's like, hey, John, I'm sort of like, well, this is like, you don't know me. You can't call me that. And I don't even make people here call me Dr. Larson, but it's for some reason an email feels a little different. So I think our main message here is don't necessarily focus on the rankings that you might find online. Focus more on finding a mentor at these institutions that you connect with that's doing work that you want to do, somebody that can help you build a career. Kind of have an idea of what you want to get out of grad school. And by that, I mean, sort of have a light at the end of the tunnel. Like, what is this graduate degree going to do for you? You're not just doing it so that you can have a master's degree or a PhD. You have a reason for it. And just making sure that you work hard at finding the right person for you. Any other additions to that sort of summary list?
One way to think about it that may help frame it is it's less of like interviewing for a job and more of, you know, like an old school medieval guild type system where you're an apprentice and you're working for somebody that is training you how to do this. It's much less like a modern job. And so, you know, applying to grad school, you may need to think about like what you're doing differently. Does that make sense?
Point. Absolutely. Makes total sense. This is an old system that is still in operation in modern times, and it feels weird and different. And I think that is a fair point to make. So think about it in regards to what you want. Think about it as a guild. Think about it as a mentor that you're looking for. Who's that guild leader that you're going to be teaming up with? And are they what you're looking for? So that's our advice. Thank you to Emily Sir, listener of the show, who asked the question on Twitter. It took us a couple of months to have time to be able to respond. I know it's not quite the way maybe that you had anticipated, I don't think, the way of us going about this, but this is our response to your prompt about being an aspiring entomologist. The other thing I want to throw in here at the end is, if all of this discussion sounded terrifying and awful to you, or if it sounds like not the path that you want to go down, there are online graduate programs through multiple universities now. You can get an online MS, usually called an MS Plan B, or just the online degree. There are also certification programs. If you don't want to go all the way down the line to writing a thesis or dissertation, you can take these online certificate programs. Florida pops to mind first and foremost as somebody that offers urban entomology or horticultural entomology type certificate programs. I believe there's similar things at Penn State for people who are interested in turf through the turf program there. So there are options for learning about entomology without becoming a graduate student if this discussion was sort of unappealing to you. So with that, we appreciate your ears today for tuning in and listening. We hope that you will find us on the web and look at our show notes. We are at arthro-pod.blogspot.com. You can find our show on most all of the podcast platforms, Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Spotify. In all those instances, you have to type out arthro-pod. If you forget the dash, you won't find us. We are also all on Twitter, and you can talk to us there, and we will make podcasts based off of the ideas that you tweet at us. I am at Bugman John.
I am at Jody Bugsme, UNL.
And I'm at mscavarla36.
And we will catch you next time on another exciting episode of Arthropod.
It's time for our insect heroes to put away their nets and pheromone traps. Join us next time, same bug time, same bug channel, as the Arthropod gang make the world safe from poor insect podcasts. Until then,
keep on bugging.
If you have an absolute advisor, you're going to have, can
absolute
I say that?
What?
this is a family show.
Sorry.